Hey guys, it's time for your weekly gaming goodies update. Remember, we've got a couple of competitions going on at the moment. In this episode, remember to drop a comment below, hit like, make sure you're subscribed, and you will be in with a chance of winning the Indominus box that is coming out for Warhammer 40,000. Yay! Also, remember, when we hit 95,000 subscribers, we're going to be giving one of you lucky subscribers that cool Katachan kernel model as well. So we've got a few kind of prizes that are in the offings at the moment. To try and help us get there, please, please continue to share the video. We've been seeing it being shared across the Twitterverse and shared across Facebook and elsewhere. We super appreciate it, guys. It really is a massive help whenever you share the video with your friends. So all that's left to be said is,
yay,
weekend starts now. Hey gamers, and welcome to the Weekender. We're going to have a journey through the awesomeness that was this week. Right, but kicking off, as always, the biggest part of the show, where the little guy becomes the big guy. It's time for Indie of the Week! Who picked it, by the way? Which one of you picked it?
I picked it this time. Yeah.
You pick it? Yeah.
I did. I picked it this time. So people may remember way back in the annals of history on Beasts of War, now on tabletop, yep, of course, we looked at a little game called Cutlass, which is by a company called Black Scorpion Miniatures. And so they are our Indie of the Week for this week.
Nice. Looking back at their fantasy pirate game back
that was the fantasy pirate game back in the day, which was very, very cool. And we will have a look at some of those in a second. But the main reason I wanted to bring them up this time is because they've got out sort of like a new range of fantasy stuff, which is very, very cool. That is definitely worth taking a look at. So it's all done by an ex-Games Workshop sculptor, which is very awesome. Uh-huh. And as you can see, there is quite a lot of stuff on offer. So there's this range called Brennan Moore, which we're looking at in a second. There's fantasy football, fantasy pirates, traditional pirates, and also Tombstone, which is their sort of Wild West game as well. Yeah. But most recently, and the miniatures you're looking at here as well, in fact, are the miniatures from their Brennan Moore range. Mm-hmm. So this is a selection of sort of generic system agnostic style fantasy models that you can use in a crossbar, basically every game you could think of. In reality, a lot of people have been using them for things like Rangers of Shadowdeep, which we've been talking about quite a lot, and using them for other games like Frostgrave, for example, as well. They do some really awesome stuff, as you can see. Basically all the miniatures are presented in resin, which is pretty awesome as well. So there's lots of high detail captured in those, which is
good.
But the actual Brennan Moore range as well has some rather funky stuff in it. So hopefully we should have a look at that as well.
Is this patron or part of it then? So that's
just their front page there that you're looking at there, which will sort of show off all their new releases and that kind of stuff. But this is the Brennan Moore range.
You see a link there for Brennan Moore.
Is this named after your online persona?
More or less, yeah. But these are some of the fun new ones that they've been working on here. So they decided, why have fantasy characters mounted on random, you know, horses and stuff?
On horses, said it last week.
When we could have an orc on a turtle, a tortoise, or an elf on a chameleon, or a big fat king on a toad, and all these kind of wonderful things.
I think this is my favorite.
I like that.
Yeah.
The snail's particularly good.
The dwarf king on the snail is particularly fun.
If I was a fantasy Robert Baratheon, and let's be honest, I'm fairly close. That would be my mount, would be a giant toad. Think of the crack of riding that. Yeah. The only thing that would be better would be a walrus, but we know the halflings have that, so yeah.
So as well as things like those big characters, which are also available separately, as you can see there, they've also done a whole bunch of sort of royal guards and characters and that kind of thing as well, sort of building up what they've, you know, put together for this collection. For example, if you were trying to use these, maybe this would be a good opportunity to build part of like an old empire army for Warhammer Fantasy. You know, use these guys as maybe like Reichsguard knights or something. That would be pretty cool. Mm. But of course, you could use them in all, a whole range of different things. But yeah,
there's your big snail.
There he is, and there's even a little goblin in a cage at the top as well.
It's the only way they'll learn.
Exactly. Yeah. He. Oh. This guy's awesome. I loved it when this guy came out. He was very, very cool.
These are beautiful sculpts, aren't they?
Yeah. A lot of the time, obviously, you can see here that Black Scorpion sells stuff by the web store, so that's a good way to go and get them. But they're pretty much always at Salute. So if you know that, if you haven't heard of that show down in London every year, they definitely have a big presence there where they show off a lot of their sort of new models and stuff. So make sure to check them out if you're down there next time next year. So.
Oh, these are gorgeous. Yeah, these are absolutely.
Let's see if we've seen these guys out. I think
I believe they're the Penguin version. The first
Oh, check that out.
Yeah. Another good use for these, a lot of people have been using them for Song of Ice and Fire role playing games and stuff. Yes. Using them as kind of like mercenaries and characters for that, which is pretty cool.
Or Saga. Yeah. They'd be very good in Saga.
Saga. They'd be very good for Saga. Yeah,
are these 28 mil?
Yeah. All 28 mil from.
I think they weigh a bit on the larger side.
Yeah, like heroic 28 mil. Yeah. 32 mil to the eyes, it says on the side.
It will be interesting to see where else they go, because we've seen, obviously, the humans coming in for the fantasy there, but knowing that they have an elf, a dwarf, and whether that's an orc or an ogre or whatever that is, I'll be interested to see what style they take with those actual, the rank and file or the bards, that sort of thing, because they're very distinctive. I mean, if that is an just ogre or an orc,
stuff.
I can't tell which.
It is just beautiful stuff. He's such a talented sculptor.
But that's obviously, like, if you scroll over to the next tab, you should be able to see some more of the stuff they've been working on.
Mm-hmm.
Keep going. There we go. So here are the Fantasy Pirates. So back when Cutlass was a thing, it's a really awesome little game, actually. And the rules are available for free for you to download and play around with, which is very cool. Mm-hmm. But they came up with rules for you to play with orc pirates, dwarf pirates, elf pirates, humans, undead, which are very awesome. The undead are stunning models. And they have done a whole range of different crew members and characters for all the different races. The game plays a little bit like sort of classic games of Mordheim and Necromunda, where you build up a little crew and you take them through and develop their characters as you go, sort of like upgrading them and going on different missions. Obviously, all of this is then done with a piratey theme as well. So it's all about sort of like stealing the gold and the doubloons and raiding shipwrecks and all that kind of thing, fighting through towns as you try and free someone from prison. Oh, my God. Look at those dwarf pirates. Look at them. Oh, my God.
They're so good. They're so collectible too, you know, because I'm just sitting here thinking, yeah, absolutely. Frostgrave. Saga Age of Magic, the Rangers of Shadowdeep. I can think of loads of different games that you could just rock these out in, and they're just great.
Yeah, I back when Cutlass first came out, that was when sort of Fable 3 was like a big thing and that kind of aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And so I loved looking at what they'd done for the fantasy races in that, and then trying to turn them and sort of like build them into that kind of Albion style aesthetic from the video games, which I thought was really cool. I even like wrote, I think at one point I sort of scribbled out ways for you to make like a fable like miniatures game using these and the Cutlass rules and stuff as well, which is really cool.
Oh, Ben, you are a man after my own heart. I am such a fan. Now, again, very narrow window because I retired from video gaming. Before, I think it was just after Fable 2 came out.
Right.
So it's the original Fable that I pumped so many hours into. It was unreal. And to this very day, while I hobby, I listen to the Fable soundtrack.
It's a great soundtrack. We use it all the time for role plays and board games and everything. So.
You might be in luck. Well, maybe it'll bring you back into video games and maybe it won't. But I think we're getting a new Fable.
Should be next year, yeah.
I think we are from Playground Games, the guys who do the Forza Horizon series. So it's a big open world thing that they're going to be exploring by the looks of it. Well, rumor has it.
On the Xbox Series X, yeah.
I wonder, would that get me back into video gaming? Because I haven't found anything anything that's managed it since. None of the Star Wars games managed to hook me. Like, I have an Xbox One here. I sit down with the kids to try some of these games out, but none of them have hooked me. And I got the Rainbow Six Siege or whatever as well. No, never grabbed me. And these were all games that I would have religiously played. So I wonder if an open world Fable, where Fable meets GTA, maybe not. Maybe. That might be enough to do it. I'm going around stealing carts and stuff like that. Yeah, you know?
I was just going to say, going back to the miniature range for a second as well, because obviously this is
look at that.
The previous Games Workshop Sculptor. The work here has lots of things sort of like built off that. So the orcs, for example, that we were looking at earlier, have that kind of stylish orc feel from, you know, so you can imagine them on the high seas around Sartoga or something like that. Yeah. Same with these undead pirates, paint them up in their lavish purples and that kind of thing. Yeah. You've got the same thing going on there.
I love this. Cool. I love the look of the stuff because you can go silly with it, but it looks great. Like, just to bring up another video game, Sea of Thieves came out on the Xbox and that got me playing that. Mm-hmm. And it was a bit more like this in style to begin with, and then went off in a completely weird direction where everybody's glowing now and they've got glowing tattoos and swords are all lit up and stuff, and I'm just like, no, just stop lighting everything up. Give me this is amazeball. This would be awesome.
It's grim dark pirates, which is how it should be, really.
It don't need to be grim dark. It was still cartoony, but in this sort of style, you know, with still leathers and things like that. I really like this style, but, you know.
Lloyd, you're a man after my own heart. I prefer leather to flashy lights any day.
I think one of the key things that drew people a lot to the undead pirates in particular was the fact that they're still all dressed in their finery.
Yeah.
They've still got all their big coats and everything on. It's proper like Pirates of the Caribbean style, which is really awesome.
Just because you've died doesn't mean you don't like some nice new thread.
And let's be honest. They are probably the best undead pirates I have ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
They sculpt-wise, they are beautiful. Yeah, absolutely they are beautiful.
Gotta order some of these.
Yeah, they're more cursed than resurrected.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although One-Eyed Willie would have been sitting at the end of the table looking like that anyway.
Yes.
But as well as the sort of like fantasy pirate stuff, they've also did like a whole bunch of the human side as well, so they've done pirates and sort of Royal Navy at the same time. Mm-hmm. As you can see here as well, actually. So one of the things about Cutlass when it came out was that it had all that fantasy element to it, but you didn't actually have to put that in if you didn't want to. Mm-hmm. You could just play it as a purely historical game and use these standard, you know, human pirates to create your gangs and your navy and that kind of thing.
Gee whiz, look at the amount of them.
Mm-hmm. Yep, there's so many models that they've done for this range.
Yeah,
this is really expanded out because it was a it was a bit slow on the whole release thing way back in the day, but he's been busy.
Well, it's been a long time as well. You know, Cutlass is still available, but, you know, let's think about this. You know, this was 3 studios ago.
Yep, this is back in the one above the chip shop. Yeah, next to the petrol station.
Studio above the chip,
Oh, we're going like 9 years back, sort of.
Yeah.
We're going a good chunk back 8-9 years now, so... You know, he's a relentless sculptor, as we can see.
One of the other cool things about this as well is that a lot of the old sculpts, he'll go back over and he'll redo them and tweak them as well, or like change things on the casts as well a little bit. So if there's something that he doesn't particularly like, he'll go back and sort of change it up and tweak it a bit.
Jerry, go back, Lloyd, to Diamond Joe.
Is this him?
Diamond. Why am I getting shades of Treasure Island from him? Who was the dude at the start of Treasure Island that was staying at young Jim's house?
I want to say it was something like, was it Black Pym or something? Like
Black Pew or something like that. Yeah.
Could be. Yeah. It definitely has that feel.
Yeah. I think it's the windblownness of it. Yeah. You know, you can imagine him walking up that.
He needs to be on like a
hilly lane with the wind and the rain pelting down.
He needs to be in a crow's nest looking out over the sea.
Crow's nest would be nice.
Break out some and the thing about ships. It is, right, we now live in a completely different world again, because back when we did Cutlass as a themed week, we did a gaming table for it. We wanted a ship. Now, we had to go and buy a kind of one of them ornamental kind of...
You did, yeah.
Ship, and we did that up. But today, if you want to do this, you could 3D print yourself any kind of big-ass pirate ship you want. Yeah. Or you could pick up some of the beautiful pirate ships from Firelock Games.
Yeah.
Or you could even go and grab some of the amazing kind of ships that are done in the HDF laser cut stuff from some of the guys in the States do that.
Yep.
It's just so much choice for pirates and naval interaction kind of stuff.
Yeah, being able to put galleons on the tabletop.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Dark Ops are a company, I believe they've been subsumed by somebody else as well now, but they do like a huge range of fantasy pirate ships that you could use on the tabletop, which is great. So
it's nice to see they've done the Navy as well, and not just the pirates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
These are the guys that are making me think of the whole sort of Albion Fable thing as well. Very cool. So as well as Brennan Morn, which is their sort of fantasy range, classical fantasy range. And you've got the pirates in their different flavors and their different colors as well. Mm-hmm. They've also worked on Tombstone. So Tombstone was a game that they bought out via Kickstarter a couple of years ago now. Mm. But it was building on rules for a Wild West range that they already had anyway.
Yeah.
But obviously they came back to the drawing board and built up the range and the rules to go alongside it. And pretty much just like with the pirate stuff, they have basically miniatures for everything. So they've done cowboys, cowgirls, lawmen, the 7th Cavalry, all the different characters. There's undead, obviously, because you need to have undead cowboys.
Very Deadlands feeling in that respect.
Yes, very much so. Yeah.
Undead kicking around. My favorite,
How cool are those?
They have a set of classic outlaws all wearing the same light tan duster, which is just very reminiscent of Clint Eastwood and Pale Rider. Yep. Where you get the lawman arriving, you know, he's hired the marshal and his 7 deputies, and they never say anything else about them.
It's Custer.
But you've got this whole backstory behind it.
Yeah,
they look just like it. Yeah. There he is before he ran off to.
Before he did very, very silly things.
Well, it's all down to making a choice. You either do a big horn or a little horn. Do both.
Again, this is one of those fully fleshed out skirmish game ranges that has everything you need effectively to make a warband for that or for anything else that took your fancy.
They are some of the nicest 28-ish mil Wild West that they have out there.
I know a lot of people use these, and before Tombstone came out, they used these as the models for Legends of the Old West.
Legends of the Old West,
which was the old Warhammer historical game, which is really, really good.
It's fantastic,
If you like Lord of the Rings, it's basically that. Well, it's the progenitor for that. Very good.
Oh, it's a beautiful range.
Where's this one that you mentioned, Jay?
The Outlaws.
Yeah.
There you go.
So you open them just at the very end.
If you've ever seen the end of Pale Rider, where the Clint Eastwood as the Reverend goes into town and faces off against the Marshal and the deputies and just wanders around by himself butchering them all, and all the deputies were dressed like that. The Marshal had this rocking massive tash like that guy second from the left. I love the idea that the Outlaws aren't just wearing whatever they've got sort of thrown together. You could have these.
Yeah.
And there we have.
There's the herbs from a film you may remember. Doc Holliday with the Street Sweeper.
Gee,
gorgeous, isn't it? Oh, it's so beautiful.
They've even done like a female set of cowboys and outlaws as well. So it's not just the male models in there, which is good.
Oh, nice.
And I believe in the Tombstone rules, they can either be done as like a group of their own, or you can just mix and match them in with others. And obviously, it makes sense, which is really cool. Their Tombstone range is one that they continually keep going back to. Like when we first looked at the homepage, we saw that Preacher. That's one of the new models from for Tombstone.
But I just spot some unbridled horses there as well.
You might have.
They do like wild horses and all sorts of things,
Yeah.
I think I think they're one of two companies that do unbridled horses.
Hillbillies. No,
they may still have the bridles on, just no saddles and tack. I can't remember. I remember looking at them at one point.
So have saddles.
Yeah, they've got saddles. Yeah.
Oh, no, they do. Because
I remember I looked at them at some point in the past when I was looking for my unbridled stuff, which I've still
But yeah, so as I say, a lot of these eventually come out on their website.
There's three pages.
You haven't seen the Undead Cowboys yet.
Have they got the Undead Cowboys?
Flick ahead, Lloyd, and see if you can sign
that third page. Undead.
Yeah.
Hold on, I just want to look at this. More lawmen. Look at that. Yeah. Right, undead stuff then. Let's see.
Right, page three.
Like Pinkerton.
You think it's page three?
I think it's page three.
Scroll down because it'll be under you.
No.
Page two. Go
up and have a look at see the top two ones there that were called Tombstone.
Oh, because they're called Tombstone, right? So we gotta maybe I don't know. Flip
should
that.
Be, you know, open one up and see because well, they just
they've there. Got skin.
Oh, there's no sense.
It'd be really annoying if they got rid of the undead. Really annoying if they got rid of the undead.
No, they haven't because. I was here a month or so ago.
I think they're probably in the... I don't know where they are.
No.
Go into Tombstone on page two.
Page two and look at all terrors.
Yeah.
Hold on. Tombstone.
Yeah. Page two.
Page two.
Look for something. I think they're all terrors or something like that.
Mexicans in there. Natives in there.
An example of that.
Old West terrors. That's it. There
we go.
All the age hasn't settled in yet.
Yeah.
We know.
Oh, yes, the old terror leader. He's so cool.
Right.
So now, Mexicans first.
Mm-hmm. So maybe if you're making up a gang to sort of be sort of intertwined with Red Dead Redemption or something, you've got some good options there, which is cool. So.
Now, scaly time.
This is it. Oh, yeah.
I got a preacher guy.
Look at a big tongue hanging out.
That's
awesome.
Apparently faith in his God wasn't enough to keep him in the ground.
And it's really a bit cool because obviously they've got like a little bit of a Cthulhu vibe or something a bit weird going on with some of them, which is really good. So if you wanted to do that kind of Deadlands thing as we were talking about, this is the kind of thing you could do. So
definitely Deadlands is a definite way to go with this. There's somebody from the 7th Cavalry. Poor fellow.
The next guy, that leader character with the two guns out, was one of the sort of miniatures that really made me want to pick up the range. It's such a cool one.
It's just a gorgeous range, isn't it?
It is. There's also the fantasy football range, which we can just have a quick look at maybe. I picked up a bunch of their dwarf slayers back in the day, their sort of dwarf team. Really? They're all slayers and they're all nuddy, basically. Well, not all of them are nuddy. I think the slayers in the unit are nuddy, but everyone else is like heavily armored and stuff.
You surprised me.
What's nuddy?
Nude.
In the nude.
Oh, nudie.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay.
In the nuddy. Yeah.
How nudie?
Yeah, So they've done sort of all the classic sort of teams. So you've got Amazonians, you've got Beastmen, Chaos. You've also got like Orcs and Dwarves in there as well. And again, these are the kind of models that they tend to have out in quite a vast array at Salute and that kind of thing. You're about to go and just pick up the team. So, yeah. I picked them up way, way long ago.
What did you pick up?
I did the Dwarf team, so.
Funny, I was talking to one of the community members on Tuesday about fantasy football. I think it was Grebo Games. Just a new range of our new team out. And he was saying, is it just a small amount of diehards still clinging on to Blood Bowl, or is there a bigger community there? And I had to point out that it wasn't just Grebo. You've got the likes of Black Scorpion and
so many Millies. Companies making
There are so many, and it's not just like they do two or three, they do dozens of teams. Yeah. So clearly, fantasy football has always had a place and is still going strong, despite
it is very much so,
despite not really being supported for decades.
Well, it doesn't require an awful lot of support, you know, because once the community took it over, Jerry, it had most of the support that it needed.
No, that's the team, and their little tiny winkies are hidden strategically behind big beards and little bits of beer and gut as well. So,
but if you tilt them up, Ben, are they there?
Yes, you can see them because I have some in my collection. So,
good man, Ben. Good man.
good to know.
One of us.
It is important.
Love it. Right, guys, that is your amazing indie of the week. If you have never checked out Black Scorpion Miniatures, head on over to blackscorpionminiatures.com. I'm sure they would appreciate the visit. And yeah, don't buy up all them on dead pirates, because we want to get in there and get a few. Right. It's time for Ben to take us through the news.
Coming to you from the center of Northwestern Europe. Covering board games, war games, card games, and all that you love. It's the news.
Okay, so the first little bit of news that we're looking at this week is from Games Workshop again. And so this is some more stuff for Warhammer 40,000. Things have really started to ramp up again when it comes to production on their side and getting all that stuff out that we have seen months and months in advance as part of previews and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
This time around, it's the final book, the last book in the Psychic Awakening series, and that is Pariah. So this is the finale of the big storyline that's been unfolding as the Psychic Awakening has racked the galaxy and caused all sorts of different problems and built on loads of different things and added new miniatures and all sorts and characters and stuff into all the different factions. In this one, it centers around the ideas around the Necrons, and obviously this feeds into the Indomitus Crusade and Indomitus, which is coming out very soon as the sort of big new box for 9th edition. And this follows Illuminator Zeras, who you can see, who has sort of perfected the art of, I guess you'd call it biomancy in some way. And so he's found different ways to sort of rip and tear human parts and sort of at a molecular level and change them into all the things that he wants to in terms of experimentation. Yep. And that kind of thing.
It feels weird because it was months ago we looked at this guy the first.
It really was, yes. It was a long, long time ago when you think about it in terms of lockdown days, if you want. But yeah. He's also had an upgrade
first
himself.
First trimester.
He's also had an upgrade model-wise, so he's sort of built and bolted on bits onto himself to make the actual model itself bigger as well. If anyone remembers Zeras from editions past and that kind of thing as well. So really awesome sort of new model for the Necrons there, which will fit in perfectly well with all the 9th edition stuff coming out soon.
Yeah.
Going up against him is the forces of the Inquisition, and they are led by a selection of different sort of renegades and, as the book would suggest, pariahs. So we have Lord Inquisitor Kyra Draxus here, who is somewhat seen as a little bit of a heretic by her own kind. She has her own
rocking an Eldar weapon there,
Modified shuriken catapult that she uses there, and she also has the sort of winged beast that she has a little bit of a psychic connection with that she uses to hunt down her prey and that kind of thing as well. But yeah, an awesome sort of like new renegade there. And then there's also a renegade from years past. We've looked at this in previews way back when, but this is Ephril Stern and Kynagil from the Demonfuge graphic novel series. And they are back with a vengeance, sword in hand, resurrected after potentially the death, who knows really, against a Slaanesh demon, and now ready to fight once more alongside her Harlequin companion, Kynagil there. That's how you say his name, who is sort of on by her side, sort of intrinsically weaved into her destiny, and obviously everything that's unfolding as part of Pariah. This also comes alongside the release of a new version of the Demonifuge graphic novel. So there's either what you can see here, which is the Heretic Saint bundle, which comes with a alternative cover version of the book, plus, as you can see there, actual wax and a seal for making your own inquisitorial letters, because who wouldn't want that, right? In this day and age.
A little flashback to past times. The shop you used to be able to go into and buy your wax seals.
Well. Yep.
There's a reason they went under.
And then, of course, you can also buy the actual version of the graphic novel from Black Library. But the interesting twist on it this time around is that it's all full color now.
Yeah, it's
so
not
they've gone
good
through
twist.
And filled in all the colors and stuff to make it all brand spanking new.
Whether
or not you want that or not, Jerry,
black and white TV is dead, man.
No, I'm thinking about I'm thinking about other things that were recolored, because it's you know, they've recolored lots of films that were originally shot in black and white, and they're all terrible for it. And stylistically, it was meant to be black and white. So the fact they've gone in and added color to it will probably ruin some of the art. It's not going to improve the artwork if the artwork wasn't made to be originally in color. It's not like they just desaturated color artwork.
Maybe
it will be interesting to see what it looks like.
Unless you're in or Grognard rage. Maybe.
I've got the comic. The comic's a great comic, but it's stylistic. It's like going in and reshooting Casablanca in color. It looked garbage. Whereas whenever you're doing something and you know it's going to be in black and white or in grayscale, you account for that and you make choices. And then going in afterwards with Photoshop and going red. Isn't going to make a better story. Why change the artist's vision is my question.
The coloring artist on that project is looking around going, did he hack my webcam?
The artist had a vision, and that vision was a black and white comic. And it wasn't a choice that was done because they couldn't do color, because Demon Fudge was done in the Warhammer Monthly comic, which had color and black and white stories in it. So they chose to go black and white originally, and now somebody's going, we'll make it color for reasons.
Sometimes it works, though. If you're watching, like, on YouTube, you find these channels that take videos from like 1901 and stuff like that. They take film footage.
Film footage.
And they convert it, and they make it all high res because it was originally film, and then they color in and stuff like that. And you have all these creepy kids standing around looking at
frame rate and stuff as well.
looking at the cameraman, and it's even more freaky when they're in color, sitting staring at the cameraman. You're stealing my soul.
All I think of is Night of the Living Dead, where the editing doesn't work once it's in color, because they recolored all the zombies to be green. So when you get the one survivor staggering out and he's not green, and then they shoot him dead anyway, that makes no sense. Likewise for Demon Fudge, I'm wondering, is it the same sort of thing? Because there are little bits in this where you're going, are they possessed or are they not? And if they start going in and craning over all of the possessed Sisters of Battle in pink or something because it's Slaanesh, then you're going, well, she's not that color, therefore she's fine. Why are the Inquisitors hassling her? So it depends how they do it, but if they make just broad sweeping choices because colors are fun.
I could listen to you all day, Jerry. You just talk so much sense, my man.
That's one word for it.
It is a pleasure.
Maybe it'll be fine.
No, it won't. No, you've convinced me now. It absolutely won't.
But you have wax seals, so you can see. Stamps on everything. I imagine they did just go round.
What's next, Ben?
So next up is some news from the guys at Wizards of the Coast. They have outlined what's coming next in their storyline for the world of Dungeons & Dragons. And they are heading back into the Forgotten Realms and up to Icewind Dale with the Rime of the Frost Maiden. So this is going to be a new adventure that is sort of situated up in the frozen north there of the Forgotten Realms and Faerun. And it's all going to be a little bit horror, a little bit fantasy. One of the things they talked about in the launch stream for this was that they're going to be sort of taking cues from things like The Thing and Alien and that kind of sort of mentality when it comes to horror stories, where nothing's quite as it seems. So maybe some people are going to be infected, all that kind of thing, messing around with magic and that kind of stuff too. So there's some really interesting stuff they're doing going with when it comes to that kind of angle with D&D, which is very, very cool. Telling a little bit of a different story as opposed to the traditional one of just dealing with, you know, dragons and all that kind of thing, which is very cool.
I have two questions.
Yes.
Question one. Mm-hmm. What is that monster on the front?
Yeah.
It's an owlbear.
Well, it's got horns. Owlbears have horns?
You'll see a miniature for it in just a second when we look at the other link. And it's incredible. It has the name underneath it. So,
my second question.
Yes.
Who reads this shit? No, really, who reads all this stuff? Like, for me, D&D consists of a rule book for me as a GM, a rule book for you as a player, and a big ass monster manual. What else do you need? Like,
in fact, this kind of book is exactly made for me. Basically,
I can see
you read this shit. Okay.
Because there are so many times while I'll come up with creating my own sort of like worlds and that kind of thing. But when I can't be asked to do any of that, I'll pick up a book like this and I'll use that as the process for me to tell my stories on the tabletop. So having something like Rime of the Frost Maiden is a good way to sit down and play through just one big campaign with that being the focus of it all. Like, for example, I've done it in the past for Dragon Age, for example. They came out with loads of different supplements for that. And I just used those as the sort of basis for my campaigns and then sort of added little bits here and there if I wanted to and that kind of thing too. So people have definitely, like, people followed the storyline when it first came out for Tiamat and her rise. That was the first big story line, and so everyone read that and sort of played into that when it came to sort of telling.
Well, not everyone read it. I didn't.
A lot of people did. So,
but also, if you've got people coming at D&D from way of computer games, Icewind Dale and the Forgotten Realms are a big part of the D&D
PC game stuff.
PC games.
Yeah. All right.
So, yep. So people will be aware. No, it doesn't apply to me either. Setting there.
Okay. I'm. Do you know what? I'm a Stone Age role player. Right, because I just never made it out of the dungeon. I just keep going deeper and deeper, man. You go down a corridor. There's a door to your left and a door to your right.
Well, like, I mean, as you can see by that stack of books behind me, I do tend to have quite a few.
Have you read them
books,
though, or are they purely for decoration?
I've read most of the Lord of the Rings ones. I've read maybe. How many D&D ones are there? What, one?
A lot. Two,
three, seven. Four,
five, six D&D ones there, seven, because there's one on the other
seven,
side.
There's
well.
One on the
I've
other
read
side,
maybe yeah. five of those, because obviously I've read the core books and then two of the other ones. And then cover I to tend cover. To like flick through them. Well, those ones cover to cover, but then I flick through the others. So,
yeah. Uh-huh.
One of the big things that a lot of people don't do nowadays is they never actually properly read the Dungeon Master's Guide. Yeah. There's so much stuff in the DMG. That is amazing for making stories and telling things and encounters and that kind of thing. And people just kind of gloss over it because it's like, oh, it's just going to be how to DM part four or something. And there's actually loads more in there. So,
I don't know. You know, I'm having my grognard moment, man. Three books, player guide, DM guide. And then most importantly of all, the Monster Nomicon, you know, just a big ass monster manual.
No. The most important thing is a cool cover to hide your plans behind.
All right.
That's cool. I've got two of those.
DM screen, Lloyd. DM screen. That takes me back. Do you remember us making our first DM screens out of cornflake boxes?
Yeah.
Oh, man. You know, so you're folding out the cornflake box and drawing our maps and our lists and stuff on the inside. See, that was proper D&D back then, man. You didn't need all this. See, I didn't need anybody to tell me how to do a good story because I wasn't interested in doing a good story.
That's it. If none of this stuff smells like fire, then it's not right. It has to be all burnt around the edges.
Yep. The amount of parchments that we tried to make by chucking paper into the oven
into to see the oven.
If we could age it.
Talking of monsters, this leads us on to what Gale Force 9 have been up to. So obviously a lot of people will know that Gale Force 9 do the official miniatures, sort of licensed miniatures, on sort of like a bigger sort of resin scale for their different campaigns and stuff. And so obviously they're doing exactly the same thing for Rime of the Frost Maiden, and they've come up with a big list of previews that are coming our way very, very soon.
Okay.
So as you can see, you've got things like the Frost Giant Ravager there, which is very cool. And a whole bunch of other miniatures that they've been showing off. Some of them are very traditional, and you'll recognize them from
campaigns
past. So things like the Ice Troll, for example, there, which is really cool. Mm-hmm. But then some of them are slightly more sort of esoteric and a bit weird as well. A lot of them are tied directly into the storyline itself. So while Ice Witches obviously exist within the world of D&D, these ones are themed more towards the actual artwork that you see from those particular the books and stuff, which is very cool.
A Yeti.
You've got a Wampa there.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Poor look.
Yeah. There you go. A new character class, which is very, well, not a new character class, but a new character model for sort of Barbarian as well, which is really cool. Mm-hmm. And some of his animal companions, which is pretty awesome. But yeah, I believe there's something like 15 new models that they're coming out with. Some of them need a little bit of work and stuff here and there. They're also still in the work in progress stages right now, but they are starting to work. This is the kind of thing when I talk about sort of the weird and wacky stuff. So this is the kind of stuff that maybe isn't in the main D&D books, like Monster Manual, but you might find it in Mordenkainen's Tomb of Foes.
His horns. So.
Where's his horn?
No, there is a proper one all the way at the bottom.
Oh, okay. Well, because a horny owl bear is something completely new to me. I want to explore this. Okay.
This one, everyone really liked. Everyone really liked the giant skeleton.
Because
once you've seen one frost giant, you've seen them all. But a frost giant, Skelly Bob. That's all.
And a dragon of black ice. Check that out. That is. What are they?
They're quirky little fire creatures.
Twin Gaz. Like little sprite.
So there's Ariel, which is the new character from. The main character from Icewind Dale, Rime the Frost Maiden, and there's her in her slightly more bestial owlbear style form, and then in a sort of ice form as well, which is very cool.
So a shapeshifter,
I believe so. Yes.
Yeah. Well, they got the owl legs right anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Did you know that oil babies sleep on their fronts?
What, like face down?
They sleep. Face down, because their heads are too heavy to support, so they can't sleep sitting up. So they just go flop, like my children. Wow. Run around all day and then just go poof,
but
and then lie on their face.
I assume because they're an owl, they can just turn their face around.
No, just slap. You will find a picture, and I'm sure we are displaying it as we speak. But owls sleep.
On the laser display board.
There we go. Right, Ben, what's next? Where are you taking us next?
So next up, a little bit of different dungeon delving. So a lot of people will know Cephalofair Games, who are responsible for Gloomhaven, the biggest board game that has ever existed, according to BGG. And obviously it had a recent Kickstarter for Frosthaven, which is the other big new box which is coming out. But the problem with both of those games is that, as well as being insanely sprawling in detail and scope, they also a little bit expensive. And so this, which is Gloomhaven Jaws of the Lion, is a cut down introductory version of Gloomhaven that you can dive into. It's completely Gloomhaven once you get into it. The first five scenarios are dedicated to being almost like a little bit of a tutorial, introducing all the different mechanics into the mix as you go. From that point onwards,
sorry. This is it. This is the layout of
that.
So that's all the
contents that you get inside it. So once you get past those first five scenarios, everything after that is proper Gloomhaven. So it's choosing which missions you want to go to, sticking new locations down onto a map, going to them and choosing which path you want to do, making your choices and consequences and all that kind of thing as well. The only thing is, as I say, they've made this slightly more accessible. So it's a lot more cut down in terms of its sort of scope. 25 scenarios more than compared to like the massive, like 100 and however many odd there are in Gloomhaven, and then even more in Frosthaven beyond that. There's only four characters rather than any that you unlock along the way. So there's lots more focus on those characters being the ones you play as throughout this. It's completely compatible with being played solo, two player, three player, or four player, however you want to play it. And again, it has that really nice Gloomhaven charm of having the miniatures be for the characters. And then everything else in the box is standees, and as you can see there, that fold-out ring-bound map book. So instead of having to mess around with effectively a library's worth of tiles, as I've had to do in the past with Gloomhaven, you just open the book to the page you need, slot another book underneath it if you want to, kind of using all that kind of thing we've seen before from like map book companies and that kind of thing, and doing it that way instead.
Cool. What happens? What happens if I progress off the tile and you're still on it?
Well, because
just turn the page and just fly you into space. Whee! Well,
thankfully, the maps are all self-contained, so you only have to fight within those. There's no flicking someone off of. There's no dexterity element to this, which is cool.
You have to keep up, because if you don't, you're being turned over.
A key thing about this that I wanted to talk about as well is that if you want to play a dungeon delving game and you want to have like really good mechanics, this is a game that does that. Like the way they sort of play on that is very, very cool, because the whole idea is that you have a hand of cards, and as well as that being your actions and the way that you move and all your powers and abilities and that kind of thing, it's also effectively your stamina and your tracker for how long you can stay in the fight. So when you're playing and you're playing your cards onto the tabletop, you've got to make real decisions as to whether or not you want to go like an all-out burst and do loads of damage straight away, you know, use some of those cards and burn them and throw them into your lost pile rather than into the discard, or whether or not you want to take it slower and that kind of thing. So there's a timed element and sort of a lot more like cooperative sort of plan making between everyone at the table, as well as just being sort of like waded and kill all the monsters. There is loads of that, obviously, but it's a little bit more tempered as well, which I think is really cool. It's very, very good. So
cool. Right. We have a Kickstarter from Sally Forth next.
Yeah, so this is a Kickstarter that is coming up, I believe it's even this weekend. So this is for the guys at Sally Forth who have done things in the past that we've looked at, like Albedo, I believe it's called, which is the sort of like animal anthropomorphic sci-fi game. This is a new mass battle fantasy game they're working on based on the work of L. Frank Baum, who created The World of Oz. Well, this is their take on it called Wars of Oz. And so the whole idea with this one is that you're going to be making up strange, weird, and wonderful armies that are going to be battling it out on the tabletop for supremacy of the World of Oz, which in a weird mesh, sort of mesh of ideas, is almost set between a mix of our world and their world in a post-apocalyptic sort of scenario after, I believe it was the First World War, where a massive like madness bomb went off and caused all sorts of strange circumstances to arise. And in the wake of the wizard trying to do his best to try and bridge the gap, your armies are fighting out for control of everything.
So this is like Oz. As in
Wizard of Oz.
By my pretty...
This is set within that world, yes.
It's amazing. Those scarecrow pumpkin head dudes are awesome.
So they've already said that they've done loads of stuff when it comes to looking at not just the original sort of source material, but also the films and that kind of thing that people are aware of. So you've got things like Munchkins, you've got Pumpkin Men, you've got Tin Men, Flying Apes, Cowardly Lions and all that kind of thing as well, Scarecrows. All that
I look forward to seeing the Wheelies.
I was thinking that. Yeah. Those are the ones from Return to Oz.
Return to Oz. Uh-huh.
Yeah, but they're going to be those as well.
Yeah, yeah. But they were also from one of the books, the one where she got washed overboard and ended up in the other continent, Eve. So so it wasn't just made for the film. It's part of... I mean, he did dozens of books. Oh, yeah, most people
think there's a complete fleshed-out world of Oz.
After the success of Oz, he didn't stop with Oz until he died. He was very much the J.R.R. Tolkien of his time. So, Oz, I think, is a dozen or more books. So
it's
there's
weird,
Return to Oz and Wizard of Oz and Oz and Back Again.
Because in general culture, nobody seems to recognize that. Because like you've got The Land of the Witch and the Wardrobe.
Yeah.
And there's tons of books. Barney, and you've got loads of Lord of the Ringsy type books and stuff.
Yeah.
And then Oz.
And then Oz, you think Wizard of Oz, that's it. But no, there's certainly more than a dozen. I don't know how many because it's been a long time since I went near any of them. But there's a lot more world building in them as well because you've got Oz and all of that nonsense that we know from the film. But then there's a big desert. And then there's like another continent and a whole other world, another place, which is Eve. Which you never hear about in The Wizard of Oz, but then it's always because you can't cross the desert, but it crops up in the subsequent books from essentially, instead of being plucked up by a tornado, it gets washed overboard in a storm and winds up shipwrecked there. So there's an awful lot to go on. And then I think with this, if they're doing that sort of blend of our world and Oz and all of that weirdness, if anybody watches Supernatural, there was a whole slew of stuff set around Oz in Supernatural where things went very badly wrong with that.
Really?
So they've got like an ongoing war post Dorothy leaving Oz, going everything's fine. It's like, it's not fine.
So the books don't revolve around Dorothy constantly going back to Oz?
She does go back in several of them, yeah. But then there are other books that are not anything to do with Dorothy. They're more Oz-centric and focused around other characters. To a greater or lesser extent, they were, which is probably why a lot of people don't.
Why you watch the show, folks. This Friday night, you have learned something that you didn't know.
Very true. Yeah.
Jerry, drop the mic. Boom.
Just another cool thing about this for those that are interested in the actual miniatures themselves. Sally Forth have worked with Old Gory on these, which we've talked about on previous shows. So they're all going to be in sort of proper old school pewter and lead for you to use in your games. So,
God bless.
Yeah.
Well, there probably isn't any lead in them.
No. Well, probably not lead, no. But yeah. looks kind of weird and quirky, which is pretty awesome.
So, what's our buddy Joseph McCullough working on now?
So this is a new sort of collective creative effort by Joseph McCullen, who's done Frostgrave, Ash Barker, who people will know from Last Days, which is the zombie apocalypse game, Mike Hutchison and Joe McQuire, Sean Sutter, who did Relic Blade, which we talked about before as well, and also Greg Horton, who works on a bunch of sort of like accessories and that kind of thing, game mats and stuff for people to play on. They've all joined forces as indie designers and developers within the tabletop world to create a new magazine called Blaster. And this is an anthology that's going to be out every so often. And inside it, you get a whole bunch of different alternative ways for you to play their games. So for example, in this one, which is very cool, as you can see on this contents page, they actually did some really awesome stuff for Gasland. So they took Gasland, which is a fantastic sort of Mad Max style race fighting game, and turned it into a Martian racing game, which is very cool. With Last Days, they set it back into the Wild West rather than it being in a post-apocalyptic modern setting. There was some new guild that was introduced for Relic Blade, which is very cool. There was the addition of Beastmasters and using sort of animals within This Is Not a Test, which is a sort of like post-apocalyptic, almost kind of Fallout style game from Joseph McQuire. And then Joseph McCullen also did an entirely new scenario to use within Rangers of Shadow Deep, which is called Rangers of the Watchtower, where you have two scenarios, one based around Gandalf and one based around Aragorn and the Hobbits atop Weathertop. And this was all done because he painted up a bunch of figures and wanted to have a scenario to play around with it. And so he put it together in this book here. And as I say, it's a collection of minds coming together from across the indie game developer sphere to make this new anthology. It's really good. It's available both digitally and physically. I've had a flick through it and it is very, very fun. So definitely go and check this out if you're interested in any of those games and try and play them in a different way.
Fantastic. We have some new and quirky character releases for Moonstone coming out.
Yes.
Moonstone, I think we mentioned last week, yeah?
We did, yes. So Jerry mentioned it last week in sort of when we were talking about the way that the mechanics work and that kind of thing. And in fact, I'm going to let Jerry talk us through some of the new releases and stuff that we've got coming out for this one as well.
So last year, they ran a Kickstarter that introduced a couple of new factions to Moonstone, and these are now hitting pre-order for regular type folks who weren't in on the Kickstarter. So these are for the Les Chevaults, the Spirits and Cultists, which is both a faction and also some of these things can be used in current existing troops. So they're very much the idea that they revolve around the Horned God. So if you remember Robin Hood with Conry in it, and you had the hooded man kicking around, and it's more about nature,
life,
death, and balance. So you've got some people who come down more on the life side, and you'll see on some of their boxes that they may have the little Commonwealth symbols, so they can be used in the Commonwealth. You'll find some, like the first group there, the Cursed, which are very much more the death side, so they are undead revenants or corrupted the beast, or the Strigoi vampire trapped in a little girl's body. And so they could be used for the Dominion, or they can all be combined into just their own separate faction, giving you this very unusual feeling group. So with the cursed are, you know, essentially monsters. The End Is Nigh is a pack that is solely for the Chevult. And they are more whimsical in nature, and a little more capricious, as sort of nature is often shown, being that sort of grey area where what they're doing may seem evil or wicked or good, but you know, you can never really know what they are going to be. So, for example, Callista there is a priestess, and anytime anybody dies, she gets more energy, which means she can do more healing. So she's a healer, but she's a healer who works off the fact that people around her are dying. Then you've also got these two. So Brother Daniel has been a little moon-touched, shall we say. Yes, he does look like Justin. Yes, he does have a unicorn thing on his head, and he is frolicking around the place.
I thought that was an ice cream cone. Yeah.
But he's, Brother Daniel is essentially a healer, though, who doesn't require people to die to be able to heal. He just like fires out AoE heals, but occasionally he'll just go, ooh, shiny, and then just bingle off somewhere else, and you'll not see him for a little while because he'll be doing weird stuff. Kavanagh is a gnomish juggler, and he is just capricious himself because he can force people to drop stuff that they're carrying, or he can, you know, help friends by causing damage to them to give them more energy, and then energy in the game allows you to do more things. So you have to weigh up the, do I want him to chuck balls at my head, which will hurt me a little bit, but will allow me then to actually be able to knock off somebody with one of my big energy building powers. So it's really nice to see these coming through, because these are just scratching the surface of the Chivalt.
He looks like he could be chucking water balloons.
He could be which, water balloons, could be baseballs, could be rocks. They may just be leather covered rocks for all we know with Kavanaugh there,
which is great, because I visited my mum yesterday,
threw water balloons at her,
so she stood like 3 meters away from me, and I sat on a bench 3 meters away from her. But it came up in the conversation, you remember that time when someone came around to the house?
Yes.
And we had spent all day filling our bathtub with water balloons. And
my word.
And this lady, water balloons and big ass balloons filled with water.
We were just waiting on a victim. And this lady came around from the school to talk to mum. And we spotted her and we pelted her.
Out of our bedroom window. We didn't realize that she was coming to visit our house. So we chucked the water balloons out of the house, and then she came into the house and went, our mum went psycho. I mean, she went utterly psycho. She came charging up the stairs with a kitchen galley knife and plunged it into every balloon in that
house. Oh, not every balloon.
Making.
We spent all morning blowing up 300 of them. They were all gone in like 6 seconds. Boom, 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 boom.
Yeah, and it was like,
could have been worse. You know, so if you'd seen your mother running upstairs with a knife, the water balloons would not be my initial concern.
Right. I have a little bit of 3D news that I would like to cover. Right. It's this 3D printing is the shit. Yes, I know. I'm going to talk to you about a 3D model, but I want to frame this into why I'm looking at what I'm looking at just at the moment. So in the last couple of weeks, it might be a bit more than a couple of weeks, 3 or 4 weeks, I've been having a little look at a game by a chap called Rob, okay? He is Rob Salters. Let me just double check and make sure that I'm getting that right. Yeah, Rob Salters. Sorry, Rob, butchering your name. I tend to do that.
Don't worry, not get salty about it.
No, I hope not. Rob Salters has wrote a game called Battle Space, okay? Which is, I would call it an ultra-modern, okay, game. Lloydie, you have the PDF there.
Yeah,
if you can bring it up, and we can just have a look through it. So, Battle Space is a ultra moderns combat game. Okay, he's establishing a little studio. It's just him at the moment, called Table Salt. And what I like about this is, I'm trying to kind of pitch this at you, Jerry. There's a couple of things I like about it. One is it's incredibly simple. Okay, there's basically some combat cards that you use to get all of your kind of stats. You have gear cards, you've got situation report cards, and it is just a really nice, elegant little game, right? So I've been quite taken by this. Now, I'm still very much in the early stages of my exploration of this, but I'm really, really liking what I'm seeing. And he's doing rather well on Wargame Vault, where there's quite a bit of a following of us now gathering up behind this and thinking, yeah, this is nice. This is kind of cool. The other reason I like it is that Rob himself is a veteran, and I'm always... Look, everybody has a game in them. That's the old adage from the granddaddies of our industry, the John Stallards, is everybody has a game in them. But I'm always particularly interested in the games, game designs that come out of veterans, because I always feel that I'm interested to see their take on it. Having, I don't know, having firsthand cordite experience of the whole thing, I'm always keen to see how that that experience that they have comes and pans out in the craft of them putting together their game. So I'd explained to Rob that moderns is a passion of mine. Ever since, I played Rainbow Six Vegas on 360 to death. It was the game that I loved beyond anything. I'm always into my modern games. A lot of it kicked off with the Full Spectrum Warrior. I thought Full Spectrum Warrior was an incredible game. So it's an area that I really, really love to immerse myself in. But I explained to him that just over the years of On Tabletop and Beasts of War, I just didn't get a chance to do an awful lot of moderns. They're only really starting to pick up with a lot of choices and stuff in moderns now. Previously, whenever I did it, I had to buy like 135th scale kind of kits to put together to do a little bit of moderns with. But I'm going to get stuck into this now. I'm hunting around the different ranges of moderns and stuff at the moment. So I'm going to look at the likes of Dish Dash and the likes, because I want to get a Delta Force on the table. I want to get some Humvees. I want to get a Black Hawk. I want to get all that cool stuff. But in the meantime, 3D printing has played its part by the amazing guy at Printable Scenery.
Just before you get into that, though, I'm getting like a Delta Force vibes off this as well. No, the video game Delta Force, it was great.
Yes.
Because I just spotted in the manual, so I'm looking at the scenarios. There's this one, like a little village thing at night, and then there's one with like an elevation.
Do you remember, right, when me and Lloyd played Delta Force, it was hilarious because we'd all spawn in the middle of the village, and every one of us would just scatter and run for about like a quarter of a mile to find some spot on top of a hill as far away in the map as you could, and you'd just whip out your sniper rifle, and that would be it. The rest of the game would be spent camped on top of a hill,
waiting
for a pixel to move. Just bang!
It moved. Rudy must be over there. And the other thing I like to do was when there was the village, run down and try and clear it out in like less than 15 minutes, just on my own, yes. Commando style. Yeah.
You were so deadly aggressive at it, man. You were deadly aggressive at it. Anyway, I've started, as well as looking at the minis, I've started to put together my map. And the guys at Printable Scenery ran a Kickstarter recently, if you can bring up their homepage, and they have started to deliver on that Kickstarter. So that Kickstarter had a number of different themes.
Where do you want to be? This the Kickstarter?
Well, this is the Kickstarter, Brave New World. So there was three main themes. There was that kind of New Eden theme, which is your kind of alien Star Wars-y kind of temple-y kind of thing. Waste World and Sanctuary 17. Now, in Waste World, there was, if you go into to that site there, Lloyd, yeah, and scroll down, the crashed aircraft up.
Oh, yeah. I remember this on the campaign, yeah.
Now, one of our community members, Laughing Boy, printed this recently. And I watched his progress as he printed it. And I literally had that Wargamer moment of, trying to resist. No, can't resist. I lasted about 48 hours. All he had to do was put up like three photos over the 48 hours. And that was it. I thought, got to do it. Because
Shiny syndrome got you.
Yeah, it was. It was a case of I had been on the lookout for what was I going to do mission and table-wise anyway for my first ventures into battle space. And we got to printing. So I set Justin a task, and I said, Justin, mate, fire up the printers, get them going. And now, good old Justin always takes a couple of goes before he can do anything, but he got there in the end. So I now have, I haven't cleaned it up yet, but I now have this shiny wow. aircraft. Where do you see all the parts? Ooh, fuselage.
You could have it come down in the Amazon or something and have a special forces unit go in.
This is exactly what I'm thinking. Right? No, the fuselage he printed twice because the first one he printed, he didn't set the resolution high enough for me. So I rejected it. I said, oh, that is not good enough quality for my adventures in battle space. That needs to be better. So he set it up to print again. And didn't watch the filament, and the filament ran out. But
that's maybe even better. You can play inside. Access.
Now it's been smashed up even more. So,
but I said to him, "You're a dick, but don't worry about this. This could be a Bob Ross happy little accident moment right here, because look at the access that you get. Right? Let me see. We can focus. If you embiggen me, Lloyd." And then I can kind of see.
You are embiggened, don't worry.
Oh, I am embiggened.
But nothing's getting sharp.
Okay, right, hang on. If I embiggen, there we go. Right, so.
Oh, there. Sharp.
Okay.
With a bit of practice, sharp.
So, there, what I'm thinking of doing is not just filling this in, but actually putting some wires and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Looping. Out of that, almost like wired.
That'd be cool.
Trunk and stuff.
You want to get some seats as well and scatter them around the place.
Yeah. I must see if we can print some seats. And
There was a lady on a flight over the Amazon or somewhere like that, a jungle sort of environment, and the plane got into difficulties. And she got sucked out in her chair, right?
Yeah.
And her chair spun like this, all the way down.
Like a spinning Jenny.
So it's kind of slowed her down, and she's the only survivor of the plane crash.
Bloody hell.
And she had to survive like 20 days or 40 days or something like that in like an Amazon type jungle all on her own. Yeah.
Check this bit out. Isn't that just lovely? I haven't cleaned it up yet, so I still have a bunch of cleaning to do. And here's the cockpit.
What is it? Is it a Learjet or what sort of aircraft is this?
Well, it is a private jet of some sort. But what I was actually thinking of doing is because I do have two bits of fuselage, I thought I might actually just clean up both bits of fuselage.
Just have a longer plane.
Put them together and create a kind of a longer plane. So the kit itself comes in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 parts because you get two... wings as well. Let's look at them. So there's your wing fragments.
That's cool.
It's just so cool. Once I get this all cleaned up, this is just going to be rocking, absolutely rocking as a kit on the table.
After that, you should get yourself a subway train set up. That'd be cool too.
Always with the trains.
With the platforms and the tracks and then like a bit of a carriage that's been like exploded so you can play inside it. Oh.
After this, Lloyd, I'm going to do a casino. I'm going to do the casino from Vegas. And because it's like, but this first. And as you say,
Only if you get a soundboard playing all the wee jingles and stuff in the background.
No problem. You've got it, man. yes, absolutely. But this is yet another project. But the beauty of the battle spaces is I don't need an awful lot of models. Battle space should come together pretty darn quickly for me. And as you say, Lloyd, I'm just working out a scenario now of why... the Deltas are going into this crashed airplane. I'm kind of thinking something along the lines of the. Do you remember the start of Batman, the Dark Knight Returns or whatever it was?
This the one where Bane chucks him out of the plane or something?
Yeah, where they basically break up the plane midair, and then they just drop the part of it. So I'm thinking about a hijacked kind of a hijacked plane or whatever.
Just fill it full of snakes.
That has some sensitive info or something in it. I mean, maybe there were snakes on the plane. Yeah, there's sensitive info on the plane, and it's trying to be retrieved by
Snake Plissken.
Or do Jerry's suggestion of Air Force One.
Air Force One sends Snake Plissken in to go and find the president.
Or
Air Force One.
Or do the Con Air one where it's an airplane full of convicts that has crashed. You're going to go track them all down.
Gotta go and track them all down. That could be, that could be fun.
I like the idea of putting it in a urban setting and having it so it's crashed down onto a freeway or something.
Yeah.
Or into a subway station.
Or into a subway station. Yeah, there we go.
Crashed into a train yard.
That's it.
Because then you've got to have the soldiers having to deal with all the civilians rushing everywhere as well as they're trying to get to the plane and everything. That'd be cool.
Yeah. But we're right back to this this joy of 3D printing. I'll be talking a little bit more about it on Sunday's show when I come to do my hobby time. But 3D printing has come to my rescue again. I'm looking at a Battle Space rule book. I'm thinking to myself, I'm to do this justice. I don't want to just chuck some buildings down on a table. I want to build something special for this to experience it. And one community member.
It's a solo skirmish game.
Yeah.
Ah.
You don't get to play, Lloyd.
Oh no, you can. We can play together. You can. It's
You could do it co-op and stuff.
Yeah, you do it co-op. Yeah. So you do.
The thing I really liked when you saw the way that it had all been set up is the fact that it can be played on that sort of 2x2 space.
Yeah.
So you can make little tiny diorama, diorama-esque looking boards and make them specific to each mission, which I think would be really awesome. Yeah, as you can see there. Yeah.
But again,
that's really awesome because it doesn't take too much terrain to make them look good, does it? So.
And you can, then something like this becomes a perfect little centerpiece.
Yeah.
To base something like that around. And as I said, one community member later who made me get a complete boner for it, and then a call to Justin, and 2 days later, bang, it's sitting there. I've had the same experience twice this week as well. I am doing obviously my 15 mil kind of RPG Rangers of 100 Years War deep kind of thing, right? And I'm painting away at it. And this week, I just took a notion. I thought to myself, do you know what I'm going to do as a little side addition to that? I want to have an adventure with tree people. So I thought to myself, I wonder, could I print, not the tree people, but could I print the gnarly forest from Printable Scenery? Now, I've got that at 28 mil. Sitting in the studio, that and a bunch of mushrooms that whenever the world gets back to normal again is going to make an appearance as a big ass 28 mil forest mushroomy table type of thing. But I thought to myself, I wonder could I scale that to 15 mil and printed a load of little trees. And then what I intend to do is I intend to get some tree men, but I'll talk about that on Sunday. But the answer was yeah. Within an hour of coming up with the idea, I had them all rescaled and I printed them on the resin printer. And what do you see on Sunday? They've been gorgeous. Beautiful trees. Ben, so good. And then I had another one. I realized the scenario with the tree people is I could do that. My adventuring party is leading a group of pack mules through the forest. I need pack mules. So I go on, 15 mil pack mules. I see a few of them.
Or they could be loading them onto a wagon for a train.
Or train, yeah. But I'm 15 mil in pack muling, and I see loads of lovely little pack mules out there in metal and stuff like that. And then I think to myself, hang on a second. Does such a thing exist in 3D? Totally does.
It's the internet. It definitely exists somewhere.
And I have 15 mil pack mules printing behind me as we speak. This 3D printing is the shit.
Did you win one of our prizes? Find out on our prize claim center over at ontabletop.com. Here we list all our previous prizes and those who have won. If you see your username, fill out the form to claim your prize. All prizes must be claimed within 30 days. Congratulations if you're a winner.
Right. Ben, Kickstarter time. Have you a historical one for us now then, yeah?
Yeah, so this is one that if you want to go and find out in more detail, go and watch our How to Play that we put out earlier in the week. But this is a new game from the guys at Phalanx. Now, people will know Phalanx for doing some absolutely stunning historical games. They've done U-Boot, they've done Successors, which is one set around the fall of Alexander the Great's empire and everyone trying to bid for control of it. And this new one is set during World War II. So this is a game where you can either play it one versus one, with people either playing as the Axis or the Allies, or you can play it with four players, so two on each side, and you are effectively fighting for control of the world during the period of World War II. You'll be doing things like playing like cards and stuff like that in order to build up your units, you know, and where you invade. You'll also be looking at in developing technologies and sort of tackling different events as they hit you and sort of getting the sort of go up the gears of your plans and that kind of thing as well.
Yeah.
As I say, there's a whole sort of video where we've broken down how to play through a game term over on tabletop.com. So you can go and check that out, where Justin went through it with the games designers and sort of had a look at it as well, which is very, very cool. So definitely go and check that one out.
Well, I'm trying to get the board layouts where you can get an idea of what it is actually like.
One of the cool things about this as well is that there's like lots of really cool wargaming elements in there. So, for example, if you played a lot of those sort of like big games like Churchill and all those kind of games where it's very much a simulation of events, there's a lot of that in there. Then there's also a lot of stuff in there which makes it more approachable to board game players as well, which is really cool. And it's a really nice mesh of ideas, which I think is really nice. Well, a lot of people were talking about the sort of layout and the design of it. It has kind of got like almost like an abstract nature to it, but I think that's a really interesting way of looking at it, because it kind of makes you feel of it sort of being a little bit more of like a a war table, like a strategist's layout, rather than it being like a map and stuff like that.
They have taken liberties with the layout, so the track around the outside there is your globe. And you can go forward or backwards on it, which means you can have people setting up there in, where's that? Somewhere around the Med. Oh, it's gone now. So you can go from the Med. Yeah. So you see there, you can see the bit of Italy and the square closest to the bottom right.
Mm-hmm.
But then the thing beside it is your land. There are limitations to what you can put in here. And you can follow that track from there along towards India. For example, if that's heading north, or if you're going left, you're going into the Atlantic or whatever it happens to be. So you can build up these little routes where you essentially have supply lines. It does mean that they've had to chop it somewhat, so you have unusual sort of jumps. So it's not perfect, but it gives you this idea of that if you are sitting with your forces in France and you want to get to the Mediterranean and then through the canal Suez and then into the Indian Ocean, you can do that and you can set up your supply route. And when you move armies around the board within the limitations of what you can have in each square, you don't pay to move a square, you pay to move through a supply route. So if you have your route and it may be 5, 6, 7 boxes long, you can just go, well, I pay the two and I'm going to move from here to there, not just one square adjacent, but because you've got a continuous supply chain, you've got all of the route carved out, they can move very quickly. But alternatively, if somebody can find a way to break that, then you may find yourself cut off.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating fascinating game, the way they've put it together, because you have this not only warfare, but you also have an arms race. That is the technology board. Mm-hmm. And when you're playing cards, you can choose to move these cubes up to the top row, and you can see the brown section there. That's the movement of your forces. That's the next one along is how much damage is required to kill something. And then the next one, I think, is some form of technology upgrade or reserve.
Yeah.
So if you move the brown cube up, that would change it from costing you 2 to move a force to being 1 to move a force. Mm-hmm. But then that's taking your turn away. Or you might decide, well, sort of, I'd rather have 2 pips to cause a kill rather than three pips to cause a kill. So maybe that will be the way I push my technology or push it into the Navy. And these are not symmetrical for all forces. So Japan obviously have more in the way of their technology forced into the naval side rather than the ground forces side, and trying to get things front and center. You know, you're on a race to build an atom bomb. You've got a little at the far, you just see like the V1 and V2 rockets there kicking about on the right hand side. So you can choose where you're putting your resources, but you have to then work on the idea that if you're putting them in here now, then that's taking up time when somebody might be moving military around on the tabletop in front of you instead. So it really gives you this sort of stress of what is the most appropriate thing I need to be doing now. Can I afford to take the time to build up these resources, or should I just be cutting off Poland?
The everlasting balancing act.
Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah.
This is the tabletop simulator sort of version incarnation.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
But this, I based on what I've seen over the Kickstarter, should be somewhat similar to what they're actually proposing. Yeah.
So it's like an exceptional game.
So this is it was originally released by Wei Chen.
Yes.
So it's a board game that has existed before. They've gone in, they've changed it, they've brought in some new tweaks to the gameplay and mechanics, and then they're re-releasing it in a better version.
It's a bit like what they did with Successes as well, where they took a previous game that has existed over a series of generations and then tried to give it a little bit more of like a playable nature to it, sort of bringing it to modern standards and stuff.
So. And if you're aware of, you know, if you're a board game player and you don't mind the little cardboard tokens, they have like a basic buy-in version where it's all the cardboard chits. If you want to, then there's going to be the upgrade version that has, you know, like a V2 rocket is the turn tracker and things like that. So you can choose your sort of buy-in level. A lot of people will just go, well, you know, the miniatures are nice to push around, I'll have that. Other people go, I don't care about the miniatures, I just want the game. And being able to choose your buy-in point is very nice.
I've played many a Euro war game where everything is represented by little tiny cubes of wood, so that's fine by me. Yep.
Right, that is Domination by Phalanx Games. There's 18 days left on that one, guys, so if you fancy it, get stuck in. And that wraps us up for this week. Thank you very much for tuning in. Remember, you can come over and join us in the Cult of Games on Sunday morning over at ontabletop.com. By joining that as well, you also get to join me on my sexy pirate radio that happens on Wednesday nights. Yeah. Okay, guys, look, thank you so much for watching and have a great week of gaming.